and welcome to another episode of Cine Nation. I am Brandon Sparks.
And I'm Ben Gertz in Washington State.
Are you in Washington right now?
Yeah, I'm not in Portland.
You're not in Portland?
That's I'm gonna say nice things about the people we have on. We've got Alex Seiber,
okay.
Friend that I used to work with. Also, technically, senior broadcast producer at Crimson Tide Productions. That is a big title, Alex. Very big title.
Yeah,
welcome to the show.
You got the senior in there. I appreciate it. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. And then we also have the winner of our Oscar poll this past year, Ray Pappa, who's also a casting associate producer of reality television, who also went to school with me at Alabama and lives out here in L.A. as well. So, Ray.
Roll Tide.
Roll
Hello.
Tide.
Welcome, Ray.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So, yeah, Ben, you go ahead and do it. I'm going to let you.
Well, okay, so this is, for those people who listen to the show regularly, this is going to sound potentially a little crazy because I think I started the, you know, let's talk about this topic, but it's WWE. Not because I'm a huge fan. I do enjoy it. I have seen some of it. Alex introduced me to it. But, you know, we're going to talk about the WWE, basically, and primarily around this frame. This is how it is not just going to be only about wrestling necessarily.
Random,
but
yeah, wrestling.
Yeah, I mean, it's in particular, I think what a lot of people miss who aren't even aware of it, because I was one of those people, and that's why I wanted to talk about it, is it's an interesting window into a pretty a pretty great business model. I mean, it's a lot more sophisticated, and there's a lot more going on to make all of it work than I was aware of. The production quality, the amount of content they produce, it's a really interesting lens into what other, you know, sports leagues, other brands might do in the future. So, you know, we'll just start with the basics, basically, which is, you know, the WWE Network started, what, 2-3 years ago?
2014.
Yeah.
2014. To give you a background, was that it took 4 years to make, is what I read. It was WWE did most of their programming through USA Network. Before that, Spike TV as well for a brief time, or TNN at one point. They did stuff through originally UPN at one point through certain things, and then became CW. And then now they do broadcasting on Sci-Fi Channel or Sci-Fi. And so about 2 years ago, they decided to create their own basically streaming service for their programming. And also their back catalog is a big thing. Because I don't have WWE Network, but I was with Ray and I looked at like his subscription. And the stuff they have on there, just like back catalog of not just WWE, but also WCW, ECW, all these different brands of wrestling that I didn't think existed on there. So it's like,
well, and I think
so
that's what initially hooked me is I think I was over at your house, Alex, and we were watching one of the big events or getting ready. And I was, of course, the annoying guy with the remote just flipping through the network to see what it was. And there was tons of stuff. I mean, I was shocked what was available to just instantly stream from, like, the 80s. Like, stuff where I was like, this looks amazing. Like,
absolutely. I mean, I've lost countless hours going back and watching episodes of Tuesday Night Titans and Saturday Night's Main Event and all the great 80s shows. But then, yeah, like Brandon was saying, you know, they've bought the tape libraries basically from every major wrestling promotion on the planet.
I have the list.
You have the list?
They have ACW, GCW, ECW, Memphis, Ohio, Deep South, Smoky Mountain, Stampede, Global, World Championship Wrestling, Jim Crockett Promotions, the NWA, the WWE, the WWF, the WWWF, Maple Leaf Wrestling, and World Class Championship Wrestling. They have over 150,000 hours of tapes.
I mean, let's just say, I mean, does that start to rival like a back catalog similar to Netflix? I mean, that is a ton of stuff. I mean,
yeah.
The question is like, how many people are going back and watching some of these things? I don't know, but that's a great number to be able to, you know, promote. And it doesn't cost them anything. That's the thing is like, You buy the rights to the Maple Leaf Wrestling or whatever you're talking about.
Maple Leaf Wrestling.
I mean, yeah. Well, can I give you a little bit of context, Ben, with this? So,
please.
So people can kind of know the history, because I do know the history of this. When Vince McMahon started doing WWF originally, when he started getting into the business, his father, Vincent McMahon Sr., and I think his father as well, they're all wrestling promoters. At the time before Vince Jr. came in, wrestling was territory based. Around the country, there are different territories. There wasn't one umbrella. And so what McMahon did was he saw it as a way to combine all of these wrestling brands or wrestling companies. And so he went through each territory and bought out every single territory and bought out companies that were usually like in the South or in the Midwest, and basically a lot of the things that Ray just named off, McMahon bought in like probably the early 80s, I think.
Well, he didn't buy the territories. He would buy their stars. Like Hulk Hogan, the biggest wrestler of the 80s, was an ACW guy.
Yeah.
Or AWA guy, American Wrestling Association. And that's what they did, was they went there, they bought him, and that caused the promotion to fold. And then they went back and bought their catalog.
Wow.
Yeah, so he eventually put them all out of business. And to create one major wrestling organization was his plan. To put it on a more national base. And then more worldwide.
Just to raise
base.
A question now, like, is this kind of a situation where, because no one's watching, like, a lot of people don't, I doubt, are looking into, like, antitrust for wrestling, right? But that sounds like a monopoly, right? This is maybe a tangent, but...
Well, see, that was the thing, is that when that happened, that's when Ted Turner came in and bought... actually, to back it up, is that McMahon had bought the Jim Crockett company I think it's in Georgia, or was in Georgia. And Ted Turner was actually giving McMahon airtime for their wrestling events. And Ted Turner basically wanted to buy out McMahon and own the company. And McMahon's like, that's not going to happen. If you really want to be in the wrestling business, I'll give you this portion. I'll sell this back to the Jim Crockett family, and then you can buy it from them and start your own company. So basically, if McMahon never sold that back to the people for Ted Turner to buy, there never would have been a WCW. Because that's what Ted Turner started, was WCW. And what happened with them was that McMahon wasn't a billionaire. Ted Turner was. So Ted Turner just funneled money into the company to beat McMahon and essentially put McMahon out of business.
Right.
It's just, I know a lot about the backstory of this. And so at that point, you had WCW and WWF at the time competing, and then also smaller places like ECW in Philadelphia that were kind of competing on certain levels.
Well, I mean, you know, the history's interesting. I'm not against history.
Yeah, I just want some of the context of.
Yeah, I mean, there's been an exceptional amount of consolidation to get to where they are. I think that's the key. Is it's almost like, in a way, you know, that they've created, you know, this is going to be incorrect, but almost like an NCAA or a super organization that contains all of this different wrestling. That's not a great analogy, but I guess
more NFL. Think more NFL.
Yeah, NFL.
Like,
okay.
You have arena football and things like that going off of it. Go ahead.
Well, okay. So I guess we've established the history of it. It exists. They created this network for $9.99 a month a couple years back.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the most recent last week, right, was WrestleMania.
Yes, this past Sunday, yeah. WrestleMania 32 in Dallas, Texas, at the Cowboys Stadium.
Didn't get to watch it. I didn't get to watch it, but I saw a lot of y'all's tweets about it. Kind of made me wish I was
set
there.
Set an attendance record. An attendance record, 101,000.
Alleged.
Well, and this is the other thing, though, is it's supposedly the most viewed WrestleMania in history, according to their press release. They have 1.8 million people subscribe to the network, but that includes people on the free trial. You get it 1 month free. But they have 1.45 million people paying. And they have about a fourth of that are international subscribers. you know, I guess the thing to talk about that maybe Ray and Alex, you might know more about as subscribers is, you know, how, okay, so they launched it. I remember reading some of the early articles of the pushback from some of the companies related to it. You know, they were obviously at that point they're mm-hmm. getting into the business to compete with the networks, basically. You know, and the networks yes. didn't take too kindly to it. But it stayed alive for this long. How has it, you know, grown, changed? Like, have you noticed the catalog change or the you know, how's it changed over these couple of years, I guess?
The big thing I would say is they have original programming now. So they have, like, a talk soup type show of, like, the Edge and Christian show. And they actually have, like, real comedy writers. And I think that would be the big change where it's not just their old catalog. They're trying to have new stuff, original content. And it's stuff that's geared at diehard fans.
Yeah, I mean, so that's, to me, that's what this really dials down into is, like, how much of this sort of play, like, it's from a business model, how much of it is just trying to just get as much from your diehard fans as possible? And how much is actually, you know, how much is trying to actually, like, get your medium interest fans? You know what I mean? Like, a little bit of a difference between, mm-hmm. like, is this only intended for people who absolutely love, you know, wrestling? Or mm-hmm. is this something that, like, are there shows that are trying to appeal to a broader audience?
I think so. I mean, they have, like, a tattoo-type show. They have a cooking show now.
There's a cooking show?
I think it might be on their YouTube channel, but, it, like, they're talking about bringing it to the network.
Who's the person?
Like, Emma, she's like their Australian girl. Okay. She dates Zack Ryder. Yeah.
Okay. Continue. So they have a cooking show possibly.
You know, a talk show. They have live podcasts after certain events.
Yeah.
So it's like they want you still to watch USA, to watch Monday Night Raw, their flagship show. Mm-hmm. But then they also want you after Monday Night Raw to tune in directly to the network, to swap right over and watch, okay, hey, we got a new episode of Edge and Christian. We have a new table for three. That's like three guys or three gals or a mixture sit around a table, eat dinner, and shoot the breeze.
Well, and I think those shows, you know, kind of were what was originally missing from the WWE Network and what I think a lot of the fans that will go ahead and spend the extra $10 a month for the network were looking for. So, you know, when you think, if you take a look at Monday Night Raw and a typical episode of Monday Night Raw on the USA Network might get between 3 and 4 million viewers on any given Monday night. With just about, you know, 1.5 million subscribers worldwide, you know, a little over 1 million viewers domestically, those are kind of the real hardcore fans. So some of those shows like Table for Three or Ride Along, which is a show where they literally just put a camera in the car as the wrestlers drive from one city to another. That's what those kind of hardcore fans were originally looking for, is just to be able to sit down and get, you know, in the wrestling business, there's a term called kayfabe, which is you know, sort of the pretend aspect of wrestling. You know, a lot of people wanted sort of a non-kayfabe look at their favorite wrestlers, right? Like, so just being able to see what they're like when the cameras are off, so to speak. But of course, the cameras are always rolling on these people. And that's the whole allure of the network. So, I think it's been really interesting.
Well, and so that, yeah. I mean, Alex, I think you and I talked a long time about this one time, but about that. But give me the term again so that everybody listening to the podcast
it's,
can be
it's kayfabe, which, you know, supposedly originates from kind of a carny term. In other words, you know, like sort of a variation of be fake. So, you know, the idea is, and you would see it a lot, you know, in the 70s and 80s and things like that. Like, you know, Hulk Hogan might go from town to town and he would always be Hulk Hogan, right? He's always the good guy. You never see him interacting or riding with any of the bad guys or the villains that he's up against every week. And for a long time, you know, sort of the business held up that, you know, sort of illusion of reality. Of course, now, you know, the internet exists and everybody knows that wrestling is what it is.
Yeah.
But on 3 hours...
It's scripted. It's scripted.
Sure, yes, yes. The outcomes are predetermined. But
people aren't betting a whole lot of money on these outcomes.
But they are. They are. That might be another topic for another day. But there are betting favorite lines.
Wow.
But
are there actually betting lines for this?
Yeah, absolutely. They have
their own like DraftKings WWE section.
You know, it isn't something I would necessarily advise anybody betting on, but yeah, sure enough, yeah, people do. But to go back to, you know, the original point, you know, some of that, you know, just being able to break down, you know, the quote unquote kayfabe and you know, see shows that are, sort of in the world of wrestling that, you know, the characters that exist in that world and the people that portray those characters outside of that world, mm-hmm. Is kind of the interesting dichotomy.
And so is it almost like reality shows about these people, or is it more like a documentary? Or are they, for example, one of the things that seems like has gone on is like, you know, if they're going to introduce a new conflict between these characters, right? That could happen on social media, right? I mean, that happens sometimes, right? Where there's like a Twitter war between these people or something. I'm speculating here.
Oh, no. They've used everything from Twitter and Facebook to... now on the E Network, and it also is on the WWE Network, is a show called Total Divas, which is, you know, sort of your more traditional, what you would expect for a reality show on the E Network, surrounding their female wrestlers, which up until this past Sunday were called Divas. Now, you know, they're sort of looking to turn the corner in professional in women's wrestling and calling their women superstars like they call the men. But
that's cool.
So yeah, so you know, that is another show that I guess to continue to use the term would be a kayfabe type show, in that you know, these we pretend to sort of peel back the curtain on these characters, but really it's as real as any other reality show on TV, and that it is not at all. But
man,
then
you're really breaking my heart here with the fact that reality television might not be real.
I mean, you know, that
I know,
it's
right?
A little secret here. You know, I don't know if you guys have known that or not, but it might be more up Ray's alley.
It is still real to me, damn it. Both wrestling and reality TV is real, so let's get that straight, guys.
But going on with what Alex is saying is that's one thing, it's kind of started a little bit before, but like, that's one thing that attracted a lot of people to WWE or WWF originally, was the almost breaking of the fourth wall, I guess. Was it there? Like they blur the lines of fiction and reality, I guess, with the characters or people, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and so it's just now with the internet and with Twitter, they're just putting it on a larger scale, to where now you can look at, like, because I know, like, for example, the one that comes to mind with the Twitter feud, Ben, that you're talking about, was it Stardust and
Stephen Amell?
Amell, yeah, from Arrow, and like they put the guy from Arrow. Into an actual match, because they start a Twitter feud, and he's at the arena the night of the event, and then he gets in the ring and starts fighting the guy. So it's like they're just using different ways to. It's, I mean, you could argue it's almost transmedia in a way, is their continuous story on multiple platforms.
I mean, I think honestly, like, as I'm going to call myself an outsider here, just because I'm barely keeping up with this. But, you know, as an outsider, like, looking in, they're doing a lot of really interesting things. Like, there's a lot of this transmedia storytelling where they're not afraid to introduce something on, you know, social media or on another show or on maybe a show that preceded this weeks ago. And you're just supposed to know as a fan, oh, well, that's the lore that was established in this other medium, and then that applies right now. And it seems like, you know, it seems like an interesting example of a brand or a, I hate saying that word, but as a sports league or as a form of entertainment that is deeply rewarding people who are invested in it. The diehard fans, basically. They're targeting that group of people, and I mean, it seems like it's working. They still have a network, so I mean, that's saying something in this day and age.
Yeah, And I want to bring up this with the network, because I know when it first came out, a lot of people saw it as a failure. Like, there's the whole big story that after the network came out, it failed, and, like, McMahon lost a third of his fortune, like, one day or whatever with the stock market. Wasn't that right about 2 years ago?
Yeah, right when it started, I think the initial subscriber numbers were more disappointing to people than, you know, than they were originally hoping for.
And I give McMahon credit, because the first time he did a business of or a big decision like this was the XFL, and after 1 year he stopped it. And I feel like right now the company is sticking to their guns, because, for example, you've had people like DirecTV and Dish Network and places like that who've decide not to carry the pay-per-views anymore, to where you can only exclusively get them usually on the network. And so he could have easily, like, well, we make more money with the pay-per-views, because they're making, oh gosh, like WrestleMania, you might make how much for a pay-per-view, like $60?
Well, and yeah, so a traditional pay-per-view would be anywhere between $40 and $50. WrestleMania, which is the one big event every year, was generally going for $60 on pay-per-view. And the problem, you know, you look at it and you say, well, $10 a month and you get WrestleMania plus all the other stuff, or $60 a month for just, you know, the one pay-per-view, this company must be out of their mind. You know, obviously they weren't getting $60 a piece. They were having to split cable and satellite companies and, you know, pay for carriage fees and all that kind of thing. Not to mention, that, you know, a traditional, maybe sort of quote unquote casual fan isn't really necessarily wanting to shell out $50 every month. They generally have about 12 pay-per-views a year, about once a month. And, you know, I think they started to look, especially at the onset of, you know, kind of streaming media and all that. Let's just say that it wasn't difficult to find a live pay-per-view stream somewhere else online, live, and the company wasn't getting any money from it.
You know,
whether or not, you know, questionable legality, sure. But, you know, people were not willing to pay $50, but they also didn't want to miss, you know, anything that happened. And so I think they took a look at that and said, well, you know, if we charge $10 a month for it, we're getting all of that money back. Plus, we're hooking the people that are already watching it online anyway. We're giving them HD quality in a really easy to access manner.
Yeah, I mean, it's really that convenience trumps piracy in a way. I mean, it's not the first time that piracy has been on the forefront of people's minds when they're making these decisions. Because I think you're right. I mean, you have to have. I mean, there's a lot of examples. You know, iTunes, Spotify, a lot of these different, you know, Netflix, or HBO Go. I mean, a lot of these things are in place now where, for most people, not all people, but for a majority of people, they'd rather just sign up, pay the money, and stream it than have to deal with going to some, like, European, like, you know, streaming site that's going to split off, like, a poor, like, SD quality, you know, of one of these live events. It's just a done deal. I mean, I just think it's interesting.
I think another thing, not to get too deep necessarily into the wrestling world, but another sort of interesting, you know, I don't know if it was an accident or if it was originally, you know, kind of what they intended, but the WWE has a developmental brand called NXT. It's based in Orlando, Florida. And originally they were producing, you know, weekly shows. Basically, overseas, the WWE has they have more contracted hours of programming overseas than they even do in the United States. And and so the NXT show, which was, like I said, just a developmental show with new signees, young stars that were hoping to one day make the WWE main roster. It was an hour-long weekly show that they were sending out to fulfill their programming requirements overseas. Within the United States, that was a show that was available only on Hulu, which was a good outlet for it. It sort of hit those hardcore fans, but it wasn't something that a lot of people were really getting to see in the United States. Since the launch of the WWE Network, it was actually an NXT special was the first live event on the WWE Network, sort of a test run before their first WrestleMania on the network. And since then, in the next 3 years, this is a brand that has gone from taping their shows exclusively at Full Sail University to selling out the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York, touring throughout the United Kingdom. Not to mention, they're bringing in now, you know, a lot of stars from other wrestling promotions and indie wrestling darlings, and these people that the so-called internet fans, you know, are having to go to all these different websites and watch YouTube videos and trade clips online. They're now under a WWE umbrella, even if they're not, you know, on the WWE main roster. And it's sort of been, you know, kind of an accidental thing, but also another, you know, another one of the main draws of the network.
That's really interesting, because it almost sounds like, in a way, you know, a small thing, but because they're making more of it available, and then they control all means of the distribution of it. They own, it's a vertical integration of it. They can see the stats on this stuff and make really smart decisions about expanding some of these brands or characters or whatever that fans are responding to. And I think that's interesting, because that, to me, that sounds like, you know, for whatever the cost may have been on the buildup of this, that's a long-term investment in the fans and the growth of these, like, up-and-coming stars, right? I mean, you're investing in who will eventually be the big names in the roster.
Yeah, and already, some of the champions that existed in this NXT brand, for instance, at last year's WrestleMania, Seth Rollins was the first NXT champion. And he won his first WWE championship at WrestleMania, their big main roster show. And he's a guy that, you know, was able to develop his skills on the WWE network and then come up, won the big match at WrestleMania in a surprising fashion, and then carried the company on his back for 8 months before he got injured.
And Daniel Bryan was another one too. Daniel Bryan was from the very beginning with NXT and, like, the Nexus or whatever, the group they were in. He was one of the first ones, correct?
Yeah, he actually, the NXT brand sort of existed prior to the WWE Network. It was a different show entirely that was on the USA Network. But yeah, he, you know, was an up-and-coming star that... you know, ended up, like you said, Brandon, coming in with a bunch of other young guys and ended up making his mark and sort of transcending wrestling a little bit, to the point where, you know, his yes chant was seen in baseball stadiums and his music was being used places. And again, you know, he was a big highlight of their WrestleMania 30 show in New Orleans a couple years ago. So
even I know his chant.
What's interesting with doing, like, with showcasing younger talent is that you're really getting to see early on who plays well with audiences on a larger scale. Because, like, used to, it'd be down, like, the Florida Champion or the FCW or whatever, and the development brands they had, you just kind of played to the audience that was there. But now, I mean, you had people who this past week, they had NXT wrestlers in, like, the Battle Royal or whatever, that one ended up winning, I think, that was, like, they're competing with the high-caliber wrestlers, and it's a good way to introduce the larger audience to these younger wrestlers, which is interesting to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, prior to having that venue, you know, they would hype a new wrestler by, you know, creating vignettes and showing, you know, little videos teasing these new characters for weeks leading up to their debut on TV. Just this past Monday on Raw, you know, the Raw the day after WrestleMania is sort of, for lack of a better term, a season premiere in which they introduce a lot of new characters. And there were several that debuted from the NXT brand. The ones that come to mind specifically are a tag team called Enzo and Cass. And they come out and they have a very long, drawn-out introduction spiel in which the loud mouth on the microphone goes through his whole introduction of the both of them, and they have a catchphrase and all of that. In an arena of 18,000 people in Dallas, Texas, are all saying it word for word because this is a team that they've grown to know and love for 2 or 3 years on the WWE Network. And so, you know, without really doing anything, they have successfully introduced these two, to a wider audience. So, somebody just watching, for instance, on Monday night for the first time and seeing these two for the first time are watching 18,000 people chant along with them, even though they've never been on, you know, quote unquote, real TV before. And so they're immediately established as, hey, these guys are credible. People like these guys. I like these guys. And now I'm going to go online and buy their t-shirts and buy their merchandise and spend more money, you know? So it's, like you said, Ben, the way that they're able to get people to spend money in various ways is fantastic.
And you're creating less chance for failure with a character is another thing. It's because, like you're saying, they've already established a fan base for them. Is that now it's not a risk to throw a character into the main roster because you've already established the NXT and even the network in general of who's playing well with audience and who's not. And so there's less risk involved, I think.
I mean, I think that's what's kind of a side effect of some of this that can get missed. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this with you guys is I hadn't thought about it like this, but in a way it's a move from like the tentpole big films that we see from the studios who are very risk averse. You know, they don't have a good way to vet out talent anymore, really. I mean, that's been one of the reoccurring topics.
Point.
You know, I mean, you kind of have these big risks being taken with superhero films, and we can go with, you know, even very recent films like Zack Snyder, where people are like, get him out, he doesn't know what he's doing. But, you know, whatever, another topic. But with this, if you own your own, if you own the entire thing, if you own the minor league and the major league, you can test all along at every stage to what people want. And that's really, like, fundamentally what everybody's just trying to get to is you want to entertain people. And you just don't want to waste people's time. Like, if people don't like a character, they don't go up to the big stage.
Yeah.
You know, that's just as easy as it gets.
Yeah, and I think, there are definitely some main roster examples of that. There was, we briefly mentioned the Nexus a little bit ago. And one of the original characters is that the Nexus was a group of 7 or 8 guys that all came onto the main roster at once and wreaked havoc. And eventually that story, as all do, kind of died out, and some of the characters became very successful, thinking specifically about, you know, a guy like Wade Barrett or a guy like Daniel Bryan. Some were not as successful. There's a guy by the name of, and it's shocking that he did not succeed, a guy by the name of Husky Harris, and it didn't really have much of a character, wasn't really anything particularly fascinating in the ring. And he was a guy that they then sent back down to the minor leagues, to NXT. He developed a character then called Bray Wyatt, and he is essentially a backwoods Louisiana kind of preacher man. And he developed his own sort of cult following of the
Are
Wyatt.
Are these the guys that come out with like the light and they got all the weird
intros? Yeah, He's like the bad guy from the first season of True Detective. It's like it's
no, like, I saw that, and it actually, like, this was a couple years ago. This still bothers me. Like, this was disturbing the way they set these guys up.
Those characters, because I was telling Ray this weekend, those characters to me are very underutilized in their stories right now because they're so intriguing to me. With the characters they have, the whole family aspect of it or whatever, I think it's so interesting, and I thought they were wasted at WrestleMania personally. But go ahead, sorry.
Go ahead, Trey.
I was gonna say, I think with the characters like the Wyatts, it's like even if they do fail, so to speak, they can go to NXT and be rebooted again. Like with the superhero franchise, if it fails, okay, a couple years later they're gonna do it again. With wrestling, it's a lot quicker. Take them off TV for a month or two, throw them down to NXT, and let them try another gimmick. Hopefully that doesn't happen with the Wyatts.
Alex, what were you going to say?
Oh, no, just that, you know, you talked about them being underutilized at WrestleMania. For anybody that doesn't know. I mean, they ended up coming out and doing a segment with The Rock, who, you know, arguably, if you want to talk about transcending wrestling and yeah, into yeah. other forms of media, you know, might be the sort of the greatest export of the WWE. So, you know, mm-hmm. whether or not fans agree with how they were used or not, they took a mm-hmm. guy who didn't work, sent him back down, got him screen time, you know, on their own network without really sort of any risk mm-hmm. of, you know, doing too much harm, and ended up bringing him back up several years later. And now he's in a segment with, you know, the biggest guy to ever come out of WWE at their biggest event of the year in front of 100,000 people, mm-hmm. most of whom are waving their cell phone lights in time to his entrance. And you know, so they were able to use that platform to sort of find mm-hmm. What worked for that guy.
And when I mean underutilized, I just mean like, I think with the Bray Wyatt character, he needed to be in a match, is what I I mean, underutilized. I think it's because it does show how big he's become, is that you can put him in a segment with The Rock and no one really be pissed that he's in the segment with The Rock. It's like, I want to see more of him.
Well, I kind of want to expand it out just a little bit before we kind of wrap up here in a little bit. But I want to give people, I guess, a little bit of perspective of like just how much, when we talk about like the WWE and the network, like how much original content they're creating every week or every month, you know, like how they've got Raw right on Monday night, mm-hmm. which is a what, 2 hour show on USA?
Three hours.
Wow. And then like, so break it down. I mean, like if you're a fan, if you have the network, how much of this are you watching? Like, or how much is the average? Maybe just don't say yourself if you don't want to, but I mean like how much stuff are they making every week?
So just on television, there's a Monday Night Raw, the flagship show, is 3 hours on the USA Network. Thursday Night SmackDown is a sort of a B show that is 2 hours on the USA Network. So just on United States television alone, there's 5 hours. On the WWE Network, on Wednesday nights is the NXT brand. That is an hour show. So right there, you know, you're looking at 6 hours of just in-ring wrestling content.
Superstars.
There's also WWE Superstars.
Can you watch the USA, the Raw stuff on the network? Like it's simulcast?
No. So actually that's, you know, sort of one of the ways that they've protected their business model a little bit.
Okay.
Most of those, I think it's a month, it might be 2 months delay between the show airing on USA and it appearing on the WWE Network. Now it's also available on Hulu next day, all that kind of stuff.
Interesting.
But they have protected their television rights.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, just about a year or two ago, they signed a television rights deal that more than doubled the amount that they were getting in the past. It was sort of a little bit disappointing to investors in that, you know, it wasn't as much as they thought they might be able to get, but still, you know, they're bringing in 3 to 4 million viewers every Monday night for 3 hours on the USA Network. That's incredibly valuable to advertisers.
Well, and to put that in perspective too, I mean, it's a young male demographic, you know, typically, right? I mean, it's a coveted demo or quadrant, right? And mm-hmm. and that's a pretty big haul for a cable channel, right? I mean, what are some of the numbers, Brandon, for like a good cable show at night? 3, 4, 5 million, right?
Yeah. And I mean,
not a top tier is going to go above that, but.
Yeah, I wanted to go off what you're saying is that because I was looking at on one of the articles we have, it's talking about the amount of episodes, I think just SmackDown and Raw alone, they show 156 episodes a year.
Wow.
The average of 2.2 household rating. And what they compare it to is they compare it to NASCAR. NASCAR has 154 races a year and only averages a 1.38 rating.
Wow.
With NASCAR, 92% of the demographic is white and over 50. And it says WWE's audience is far more diverse and broken out fairly evenly among age groups. A selling point is that 44% of them are under 34 years old.
Wow.
So... yeah, just from the main shows alone, like what Alex was saying, is that it's 156 episodes a year. And Raw itself has been running since how long? It's been
93?
Over 20.
Yeah, they're right around 1,100 episodes right now of Raw.
Wow.
It's like, it's one of the longest running shows right now on television. And I mean,
January 1993.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's, and they're with, and on top with the content they're adding, like the NXT on WWE Network, and then is it Superstars? What else is there? There was one called that just for the, I guess, changed WWE Main Event.
Yeah. So actually, this is an interesting story regarding the network. So Main Event was a show that originally aired. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was. I can't remember. It had a cable outlet in the United
Ion
States.
Ion Television.
What's that?
Ion Television.
Yeah.
Ion
it was on
Television.
Ion. Yeah. So it originally aired on Ion, and then they basically didn't pay as much of attention to it as Ion would have liked, and that television deal was scrapped. But going back to their commitment to overseas programming hours, they continued to produce the show to fulfill those international requirements. And then the WWE Network came along, and it was actually a really good venue to have a live Tuesday night show on the WWE Network when the network was only available in the United States. They didn't have any problems there. They actually had some pretty high-quality matches. For a while, they were telling, you know, pretty interesting stories on that show to encourage people following Monday night's episode of Raw to subscribe to the WWE Network and continue the story on Tuesday on Main Event. And I won't get all the details exactly right, but basically the network launches in the United Kingdom, which had been a bit of a struggle anyway, kind of going back and forth with Sky Sports, where WWE programming airs in the UK. Basically, to make a long story short, they couldn't air Main Event live on the WWE Network and also have it airing on Sky in the United Kingdom. So they ended up having to pull the live shows from the WWE Network because they weren't able to discriminate by region. So they ran into, you know, a little bit of a reality check, and this was a very last minute thing. I think it was like the day before an episode of Main Event, they all of a sudden realized, hey, we can't show this live on the network anymore. It was sort of, a little bit of an illustration of the fact that all of this is still new to everybody, you know, things that nobody has thought of yet and problems that people aren't necessarily foreseeing are still coming up. It's fascinating stuff, and it's, you know, really interesting to see how much programming they're having to put out each week.
And it's now on Hulu, correct? In the US, right?
Yeah, I think it's
still,
that's what
I just
read.
It's on Hulu.
Well, and I think the thing to hook onto what you were just saying, Alex, is that, you know, the inherent business model from the WWE perspective is that it would be completely international, completely live, without discrimination of territory. It's that anchor to pre-existing business deals that, that makes them need to divvy it up, or in case they can't discriminate based on region, you know, to just pull it outright from the network. And I think, you know, to kind of move towards wrapping up a little bit, I mean, in my mind, it seems like an excellent example of what could be if other brands and networks go down this route. I mean, you know, MLB, baseball, you know, they have some of their own things. Everybody's trying to do some of this stuff. It's really interesting that wrestling has so clearly, put their chips on the table and held to them, you know, more than anything. And like you're saying, you know, investors were disappointed that they only got double the cable money they were looking for. I mean, that to me says that they have a great bargaining chip in saying, if you don't want this, we'll take it back. You know, and I think that's a great, like, you control your own destiny at that point. You can bargain in a very different way. Just like Netflix making original content, you don't have to buy anything. Mm-hmm. If people don't want to sell, fine, we'll make our own. You know, I think that's compelling.
Yeah, and I have this question because I don't know, because I don't have the network, but do they have, what I'm reading is they actually have advertising on the network. Is that correct?
They have advertising for their own, like their own shows.
Yeah, this was sort of a little bit of a point of controversy when it first started. But yeah, they originally it was ad free, and that was a big, you know, sort of part of the network was that it was ad free. And then for those of you that have never seen the network, they have a live stream, which is something that I wish Netflix would do, and that you can just turn it on, whatever's on the network, you can just sit down and watch any, you know, live 24/7 stream, or that's also available, mm-hmm. You can go ahead and pick any on-demand programming. And there was always, of course, some little interstitials for their own programming on the 24/7 stream. About a year into it, when, sort of the financial numbers were coming in and things weren't as rosy as everybody had hoped that they would be, and they sort of debated maybe kicking the price around to $15 a month and that sort of thing, they wanted to keep it at $10, and so they did start to introduce some pre-roll advertisements, and it's not present before every show, but yeah, so occasionally you'll see, for instance, this past month's WrestleMania was sponsored by Snickers, and so, for several weeks leading up to it, you might see a Snickers ad before starting your on-demand programming and things like that.
But all their ads are all wrestling-based, though, so, like, if they have a cricket-based ad, it's going to be featuring wrestlers. They have a Snickers ad, it's featuring mm-hmm. wrestlers. Because I really didn't even think about the Snickers ad until you said it, and I was like, wait a second, they do have ads.
Yeah.
But it's integrated because it's their superstars. So I thought it was a backstage vignette or something. I was like, oh no, they're pimping Snickers right now.
But so they find an interesting way of it not coming off as just a blatant commercial for it. They're actually finding a way to integrate their characters into the commercials.
And what are they calling this? In print magazines and websites, they're calling this what? Promoted content and native advertising, right? This whole idea that you can't tell the difference between an ad and the real thing, man. It's just the same. You're gonna love it. But in this case,
it's the same Portland. Okay.
No, that no one talks like this. I'm sorry. no, but it makes sense that you would try in some way to integrate it, though. And they were that. This is what I'm mainly surprised by, is that the network is still around, because I remember when we talked about it several years ago, they were actually in a pretty dire condition with the subscriber numbers. And from what I remember, correct me here, Alex, their kind of threshold number was like 1 million subscribers. That was kind of the make or break. Once they crossed 1 million, which they've clearly done and seem to be growing, that was really the number where it was break even for them.
Yeah, exactly. And that took a while. I think a lot of people thought that they would get there right away, and it sort of, they got off to a hot start with 600,000 or 700,000, pretty early on. And then it sort of hovered there, and there were cancellations. And I think before we started recording, we were talking about, one of the initial models was the 6-month commitment. And that, it was $10 a month, but you had to sign on for a minimum of 6 months. That sort of angered a lot of people, and they ended up dropping that. And then being able to launch internationally, it was originally only available in the United States. So now they've kind of doubled those initial numbers, like we said, to what are they at now? What did we say? 1.8 million?
1.82.
That's with free subscribers, yeah.
Sure, yeah, trials. Yeah. But even those that are paid are 1.45 million, and the domestic paid, which was the original, the 1 million mark that they were originally hoping for, was domestic paid subscriptions, and they're at 1.1 million there right now. So, it took a few years to get there, but the fact that they did finally get there and were able and are able to hold those numbers, I think is pretty telling. I don't think we're going to see it going anywhere anytime soon.
Well, and so just, we'll wrap up on this maybe. But I guess, now that with the numbers, it seems clear at this point that it's worked. I mean, there's a chance for the wheels to fall off at any point along the way. But they've hit their kind of the minimum number. Investors seem happy. What do you think, because of the fact that they own the entire, it's vertically integrated now. As they add more people, it's just more money on top of, it's just profit at that point, right? I mean, do you see them adding like more content? Is there any, where do you see it? I guess, where do you guys see it changing or growing? in the future as they kind of, because they're on a growth trajectory. I mean, they're doing well right now.
Yeah.
I think one of the things is that they're able to take chances with programming now, right? Like, the original mm-hmm. programming that existed was, hey, let's get a bunch of the old timey legends around and, watch them live in a house together, which is safe, right? Like, who yeah. doesn't want to mm-hmm. see, you know, these eight guys that were, you know, combatants in the 80s, and you know, who doesn't want to see old guys live in a house together, which was admittedly a great show. But now, you know, mm-hmm. now they've reached out. They've got Seth Green doing a TV MA animated show coming up called Camp WWE. You know, they've got a global cruiserweight series coming up, which is basically taking in a whole bunch of cruiserweights, you know, sort of smaller guys from around the world, guys that aren't contracted to WWE, and putting them in a tournament. You know, they're some of the shows that we've talked about. There's an animated series, and this didn't last very long, but it was called Slam City, and it was just based off of, you know, different these little Mattel toys, and they basically were cartoon wrestlers living in a city. So, you know, stuff can fail now at this point, and mm-hmm. that's okay. You know, they're in a position where if they do a dumb show, like Ray was talking about, the Edge and Christian show that totally reeks of awesomeness, that is the full name of the show, by the way. It's just a dumb show with two old wrestlers talking about dumb things. And if it fails, it fails. But if it works, they're able to, you know, hook people for a 12-episode series. Well, I'm not going to cancel before that series is over. Yeah. So, you know, I think that's kind of the great thing now. They're in a position where people aren't canceling as quickly. Yeah. And so now it's mm-hmm. just let's throw everything at the wall and see what works.
Ray, what do you think?
I think, I mean, they have their own WWE studios here in Los Angeles, and they make movies. They just announced like a new movie deal a couple days ago with like Anne Heche and Wesley Snipes. And I think a lot of their movies there on mm-hmm. Netflix. But I think eventually in the future, we'll see like their movies being launched, you know, with wrestlers in it on the network, on the wrestling network. I think they'll start branding their own movies soon.
And then going off of that, because I want to bring it back to a previous episode, where they actually helped bought the rights to a movie at Sundance this year.
Yeah.
It's not a wrestling movie, but they own the rights to it. So could they start doing things like that and streaming certain films? That's a question. If they buy movies, say like that, that don't have anything to do with wrestling, do you see the network as a place where they could put those films?
I think,
or TV shows.
I think for horror films, horror and wrestling goes hand in hand a lot of times. They bought the rights to Leprechaun. They did Leprechaun Origins with Hornswoggle. He's a small wrestler. I can see them doing that. Just mm-hmm. having their own catalog of their own films. No Holds Barred. Scorpion Kings, maybe. Like if they buy the rights to the Scorpion King and they have the Scorpion King 8 or something like that. Like eventually that'll be on the network, I would assume.
Because if they start buying, they start buying movies that actually aren't related to wrestling, I wonder if they'd use the network as a place to showcase them, or maybe not. Maybe they do it somewhere else. But also too, what Alex is saying is that a lot of the shows, just from the basic plot line or the log line of it, they don't cost that much to make either. It's like Stone Cold Podcast is in a studio. And it's just Stone Cold talking with someone usually. It's like, there's not much money going into that. And most big fans will go watch Stone Cold talk to anyone for a long period of time. And yeah, and then you're doing the whole, one that Alex didn't mention was the whole Mick Foley reality show they're doing, which is like basically Hogan Knows Best is what it seems like, but with Mick Foley.
They're trying to have a lot of these different hooks to get you into the brand, right?
Yeah.
And then if you care, I mean, basically mm-hmm. what's interesting is as they've kind of consolidated, this is again like what they did maybe 10, 20 years ago, as they consolidated around all these brands, like if you care about wrestling or if you're interested in this at all, you pretty much have to subscribe, mm-hmm. right? I mean, like the only thing you would get right now if you weren't a subscriber would be Raw. Right on Monday night.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's it in America.
And SmackDown.
Okay, but you wouldn't get WrestleMania. You wouldn't get these other critical fan.
Right, sort of the payoffs to the stories, you know, the stories that are created on weekly programming, weekly televised programming, the payoffs to those stories all happen only on the WWE Network.
Yeah.
Yeah. And another thing, too, is that when you look at their former shows, most of them are just like, are the ones I'm reading on like Wikipedia are like, they're just highlight shows from like past, like past events or past like years and certain topics. And now they're starting to release more original content. It's not just highlight reels. It's actually focusing on, like we're talking about, continuing the story in some way. And so I just see them doing, because when they're adding all these different wrestling programming like NXT and SmackDown and Raw, and they have a variety of characters or superstars, or whatever you want to say, they can find ways to integrate them into more original content through the network, is what I think will happen. Because it's just basically like you're talking about building on top of one another, and it's just another way to promote the brand, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, I'm good. I feel like we've covered some super good stuff. I mean, do you guys have anything else to add? I mean, it's an interesting topic. I just don't know a lot about this, you know?
No. I think, you know, we kind of touched on it earlier, but I think, you know, the most interesting thing to watch from all of this, like Ben said, whether or not you're a fan of wrestling or not, is that this is potentially a model that we're going to see a lot of different brands, a lot of different, you know, people in the sports industry start to follow. And they're definitely watching it, seeing how it succeeds, seeing where it, how it fails, and using it as a future model in the next 10, 15 years. I think we're going to see see a lot more of this.
And another thing I wanted to add, too, because we didn't mention it, was this is around the time I think the network started, but they said that one of the people at the company said that most WWE fans consume 5 times more online video content than non-WWE fans. And that's including subscriptions such as Netflix and Hulu. So wrestling fans actually consume more content than people who have Netflix and Hulu and maybe even Prime.
Well, but I mean, I mean, you take their content, though. I mean, if you really are watching, like, Raw and some of these things every week, that's more Netflix than I watch. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I mean, you know, granted, I'm a low, you know, different reasons. But, I mean, you know, I might watch 2 hours a week. You know what I mean? Like, 3, 4, 5 hours a week. But that's a low number compared to some of these people who might be really cranking through, you know, some of the stuff that they're putting out.
Yeah, I'm going to ask one last question before we go, and that's who is your favorite wrestler?
The Rock.
You're going with The Rock? No, not Daniel Bryan?
John Cena.
Ben, stop at. Just stop.
The guy that does the... Yes!
Daniel Bryan.
That's yes!
Daniel Bryan. Oh, I like Daniel Bryan.
Favorite wrestler. You know, jeez. Okay. I don't know. Ray, you got this?
I'm going to go two. I'll say Mick Foley. I followed him from his days in WCW. I used to get tapes from eBay. Like, he had Japanese death matches. I remember 1 year for Christmas, like 1996, my mom got me like a whole collection of his VHS death matches. So I've been a fan of his for a long time. And then,
does that mean people die? I mean, I just have to clarify. I don't know what that means.
They're very violent. There's barbed wire. There's light tubes. There's explosions. I'll send you some clips.
It's like a Tarantino film, Ben. It's just like a Tarantino film.
Not interested.
He actually lost an ear also. So,
he did lose an ear, yeah.
Mick Foley and then Macho Man Randy Savage.
My history, I didn't start watching until much later, so I'm going to... historically, I'll go with Shawn Michaels. And current guys, I'll go with Sami Zayn. He's one of these guys we talked about coming up from NXT recently, and he's just made his main roster debut, and he's a very entertaining guy, and he's going to be fun to watch over his career in the next few years.
Good choice.
Yeah, he was really good at WrestleMania. So I'm going to go with the person that I grew up watching, and that's Stone Cold Steve Austin, because I started watching in the late 90s, right around the Attitude Era. I kind of stopped really kind of stopped about a few years after Stone Cold. So I'm kind of on again, off again right now. So like when I watch them with Ray sometimes, I don't know who they are now. I'm just like, I know a few of them. And so that's why if they stick with me, like the Wyatts or, Daniel Bryan or Seth Rollins, like people that I didn't grow up with. And so if I see them a lot and they still stick with me, I think they're good characters and wrestlers. I mean, if I had to pick nowadays, I'd probably go Bray Wyatt nowadays. But yeah, Ben, do you have anything else? You guys have anything else to say on this topic?
Thanks for coming on the show, guys.
Thank you.
I think this is genuinely enlightening for people who aren't aware of, you know, a pretty big successful brand.
Yeah, and people kind of downgrade because, oh, it's wrestling, it's fake, it's this or whatever.
But I never said that word, Brandon. I never accused it of being...
You didn't, Ben. But there's a lot more to it than just. I mean, there's like people don't realize there's writing involved with this. It's. I mean, they're you're essentially putting out hours and hours of original content every week. It's not just by like.
It's a performance art.
Everything. It's. Yeah, I mean, it's sports entertainment is the term.
I explain it to my wife as men's ballet, but that might be a little offensive to some people.
Yeah, it is. It's.
I'm sorry. It's a type of dance, is what I said. I think that's a fair thing. I mean, there's a okay. Anyway, thanks for listening. You can follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook. And if you really care about us, we have a Medium page, and for whatever reason, we have tons of articles. Just tons of articles. You too could be a writer.
We have a lot of articles coming every day. We're trying to expand to some more places, and also make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes, write us any reviews, because that helps us get better at what we're doing. Ben, anything else?
Tell us your favorite wrestler on Twitter.
Yeah, tell us your favorite wrestler on Twitter. Alex, Ray, thank you guys for coming on, and everyone will hope to hear from you soon.